Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Gear 30 on the Blister Podcast Network. I'm Jonathan Ellsworth, and my foot really hurts because I just got done testing a true 96 millimeter lasted boot. It's a very good boot, but my midfoot is not 96 millimeters wide. Anyway, that's who I am and what I've been up to, and you can check out everything we're doing and reviewing over at blisterreview.com. So, what's in and what's out in terms of ski design in 2024? And how have U.S. ski companies been doing over the past few years? At our last Blister Summit, we discussed these questions and much more with Moment Ski's CEO Luke Jacobson and Icelantic Ski's founder Ben Anderson. We covered the most notable trends, why skis cost what they do, the challenges of manufacturing skis in the U.S., whether a core shot proof ski is possible, and we got some other great questions from our audience, as is the case with all our Blister Summit panel sessions. Furthermore, if you'd like to check out the video of this conversation, well then head over to our YouTube channel, which is Blister Review on YouTube, and you will then be able to check out this conversation plus other panel sessions from all of our previous Blister Summits. Plus, you'll get to see new brand lineup videos and, once again, a whole lot more. This episode of Gear 30 is presented by Lone Pine Gear Exchange, which is our blister-recommended shop in Salt Lake City, Utah, and they are far from being your average shop. Lone Pine Gear Exchange runs a robust consignment program, both in-store and online, and you can shop the entire selection at lonepinegearx.com. Lone Pine believes in consignment and used gear for the accessibility and sustainability of outdoor sports. And you can learn all you need to know about shopping and selling consignment by listening to Gear 30 episode number 284 with Lone Pine CEO Katie Jackson. You'll also hear about their impressive ski and board shop, their gear repair program, their sustainability initiatives like one tree planted with every purchase, and more. So, whether you live in Salt Lake or check them out online, Lone Pine is dedicated to getting people outdoors with an amazing selection of new and used gear. So, check them out today via the link in our show notes or stop by their store. And of course, tell them we sent you and say hi. And now, let's talk to Icelantic's Ben Anderson and Moment Ski's Luke Jacobson. Here we go. All right. We just had kind of a mind-blowing panel session about the future of comps with some legends in the snowboard game. Super tough act to follow. Good luck. But we're now going to talk about ski design and ski manufacturing. These folks have a lot to live up to right now. Luke Jacobson, CEO of Moment Skis, and Ben Anderson, founder of Icelantic. Good cheering section. That was an impressive cheering section. This is going to be a free-flowing conversation, I think. There's a couple questions that I very much have wanted to get to today. I know Luke has some things he wants to talk about specifically on the ski design front, and so he's going to give you a master class in that, ladies and gentlemen. And then we're going to get to your questions. So we have a clear agenda. That is it. Let's do the hard question first. It's always a hard one for me. Talk a little bit about what is Moment Skis. Give us a bit of the backstory, the history, and we'll have then Ben do the same with Icelantic.
Okay. Moment has been around since 2003. Made our first pair then. Made in the USA. We have the largest ski manufacturing facility in the USA. We are a North American free ride company. We make a lot of wide skis. Starting to make some narrower, more carver skis. We don't do any race stuff And we, just focus on mainly a lot of skis that work on the West Coast of the United States, because that's where we're from. But as the brand has grown over 20 years, we've definitely diversified the shapes and styles that we create. It was definitely started because back then there was a need for differences, different styles of skis. You know, twin tips didn't really exist. There were a couple. There wasn't really rocker. There weren't fat skis. And that's when we really got into it and wanted to push and evolve the sport. And that's what we continue to do today, is continue to try to make skis that are more fun on snow.
Hmm. Well done. Did you say where you're based?
Reno, Nevada is where we make all our skis. I don't think I said that.
I don't think you did.
Yeah.
Good job.
Yeah.
Ben.
Same story. No, pretty much. I mean, the timeline's pretty much the same. You know, I started building skis in my parents' garage in like 2002, 2003. You know, did that for a few years. And 2006 was our first year going to market. You know, instead of starting on factory, one of the things I realized is that I'm really allergic to fiberglass. So it was a tough hobby to have. So, you know, when we were getting ready to go to market, I knew that it wasn't something that I was going to continue to build myself and, you know, needed to outsource. And growing up in Colorado, I grew up in Evergreen, Colorado, so just west of Denver a little bit. And growing up here, like through the late 90s, you know, I knew the Neversummer brand, Neversummer Snowboards. It was kind of in their launch time and their heyday. And I just knew the quality of product they were making and, you know, the factory being in Denver. And I was like, this would be a perfect partnership, you know, to get them to make our skis. So, you know, I was kind of looking at a couple of the European factories as that opportunity, but, you know, the design and the building and just that process is what I was really passionate about. So I was like, gosh, if we could find a local manufacturer, which there was one, it just would be perfect. So, you know, it took me about a year and a half to convince them to do it. You know, at first they're like, we're content, you know, we're a snowboard business. You know, we have a sustainable business. We don't need to make product for anybody else. You know, and then they started being like a little bit nervous about making skis. They're like, you know, we don't know how our core market's going to react if they hear that we're making skis. But, you know, I was very, I would go down there pretty much once a week and just go knock on their door and, you know, talk to the two brothers, Tim and Tracy, and try to convince them to make them. And after about a year and a half, you know, they, you know, saw what we were doing and decided to partner up with us. And, you know, we've been lucky enough to work in that same factory for the last, 20 years, which is just crazy. It's been that long. But yeah, so all of our skis, you know, made right in Denver. You know, we have a core group that kind of started the company that is still with us today, which is awesome. And we're based in Golden, Colorado. So the factory's in Denver. We have a retail space and our workspace in Golden. And yeah, it's been a crazy ride. It's been so fun just to see it continue to come to life and, you know, just continue to stay creative, you know, whether it's through ski design or marketing campaigns or, you know, just how we organize the business, you know, just that creativity and, you know, staying true to it is such a key piece.
Over the last couple of years, we've heard quite a bit in the ski industry, in the bike industry about, and frankly, lots of industries, about big disruptions in supply chains and materials and all the rest. And I would love to hear you guys talk a bit about sort of where we are today, if we're still under the like big challenge kind of umbrella on things, if it's gotten better, where are we at today on the, you know, getting the materials in and costs of these things to actually go build skis?
They're very differential.
So that's a big question, you know, because I think we see price and supply chain issues in every industry, like at the grocery store, absolutely everywhere. And I don't have the answers for that. I do want to know where all the workers went. That's really where like the challenge comes from a lot of these things. It's a lot of work though, but like we're out of it. Like things got really crazy during COVID, especially for skiing, because that was one of the only things that we could do. So many people were buying up so much ski gear. We were selling skins to people that didn't have touring bindings. They're like, I'm just gonna go shuffle up the mountain. You know, it was absolutely mayhem. Like everybody just wanted to get out there during the COVID days. It was really bad. Like, but it was really good for business too. And then it was like, you know, bike has seen it too. And like bike just was like, oh, it's gonna be like this forever. And now it's like way too much stuff. It's not that bad in skiing. Like I think people have like, most of the ski brands have definitely like they pump the brakes and they go, okay, this was like a unique scenario in history, you know, but it did open up the doors to a lot more people skiing. So like for brands like us, I think we're always like a pretty small market share compared to the big European brands. So we're kind of playing in a different sandbox, so we can always have new consumers in that regard. But as far as like materials go, we had to change the entire way that we structured and purchased things. We used to be able to purchase certain materials at 4 to 6 months at a time. And now I'm buying materials for 12 to 16, 18 months at a time, just because that's what kind of happened during COVID. Like when everybody went out and bought up all the toilet paper, like everybody went out and bought up all the sidewall or bought up all the base or, you know, all these things. And the only way that that is going to go back to a normal is if someone starts to chill out, because we have to keep so much raw material on our floor to continually make skis, to keep skis being made every single day, to make the business of the factory make sense. So there's definitely been a huge money shuffle on the business side of it, on how we look at product and how we pick colors or sidewall and how we utilize things and storage space. But things are better now. It's a lot easier to get things. Like, people have caught up from like the COVID boom, but it still has, I think, changed the way that we do business. And I would assume the same with you.
Yeah, ditto. I mean, I think really every single material that we use to make skis, there was some issue with getting, you know, whether it was the cost of the shipping. I mean, just in general, I mean, the cost to make our skis went up almost $100 a pair, or just, I mean, pretty much $100 a pair. Like, our costs went up over those few years. And it's like, when you start thinking about that and the compound effects of that while still trying to compete in this industry, it's been pretty difficult. But you know, luckily we've navigated it pretty well, you know, like, you know, really getting strategic of the, you know, the type of materials, how do we store stuff and get stuff in advance so we can, you know, prevent these super long, you know, timelines that are going out. You know, one of the things that really stuck out, one of the years, our biggest challenge was resin and just the glues for the skis. And it had nothing to do really with, I guess it did have to do with demand, but it wasn't even from COVID. It was from that deep freeze in Texas. Remember when like that Texas froze, how that affected the, you know, the adhesive industry was insane. So like that, we had to cancel about 20 to 25% of our production that year. You know, work on finding new, you know, vendors to source this, you know, very specific, you know, formula of resin that we were using. So that was a huge challenge. But, you know, over the last couple of years, like, it has, you know, stabilized, you know, we're able to get materials, you know, the production's on a normal cycle now. But our biggest challenge now is, you know, paying a livable wage in Denver. I mean, how that is just, you know, continue to increase and then is going to continue to increase. You know, I think that's one of our biggest challenges now is like, you know, how do we not only pay a livable wage, but, you know, give these factory workers a, you know, a good life and, you know, keep them passionate and proud of what they're making. And, you know, that's a challenge that we're continuing to deal with and, you know, have longevity. I mean, we've been lucky enough to have a core group at the factory. You know, there's about 50 people that, you know, work on the factory floor itself. And, you know, I'd say 20 to 25 of those people have been there for 20 years, you know, that have been there for a long time and have really mastered the art. But now, like, bringing in new talent or new people to train to, you know, to get this skill set, it's been so tough. Like, you know, you're paying them a rate that, you know, the guy who's been there for 20 years has worked up to, and now, you know, it's just a compound effect. So, you know, that's definitely been a challenge and one that we continue to think about. You know, luckily we're in a fun industry and we sell fun, so it's like, how do we really continue to think differently where it's not always about monetary gain? You know, obviously you need to, you know, have a livable wage, but what are some other ways that we can truly differentiate the experience and what you get when you are working in the Never Summer and Icelandic factory? You know,
I like bringing up the livable wage portion of this because, you know, we talk to a whole lot of manufacturers in the ski game and snowboard game and the boot game. And a thing that we constantly hear is there is this pressure from we, recreational skiers and riders, about this stuff is too expensive, right? And there's a lot of other industries where they're like, well, too bad. This is what it costs. Because do you want people to be paid well who are building this stuff? You know, and you just said, you know, this stuff just got a whole lot more expensive to make. And yet we are out there rabble-rousing and complaining about these prices. And it's just something that I think it is good for all of us to be mindful of. And I'd love to just hear you respond a little bit to that. Like, look, you know, these are two nice guys. They're not like, yes, let's wring every penny from you motherfucker out there, right? But like, we got to be a little bit realistic about, do you want the things to be made well? Oh, you do. Cool. Do you want the people making it to get a reasonable wage for where they live? Oh, you want that too. Cool. Okay. So I think we are pretty guilty of being unreasonable, but I don't know what is to be done here. So thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely a challenge. I mean, there's been these like kind of like ceilings in the ski world. You know, you look at almost every other industry and I mean, prices continue to grow and there's not much. And, you know, a lot of it could be, you know, driven by a retail presence, you know, and the retail buyers looking at what they're carrying, you know, like, well, you know, how is the consumer going to process this? So, you know, I think it's a pretty interesting challenge to like really think about like this investment that you're making and what are you purchasing. You know, I think one of the things that we really have to our advantage, both of our brands, is just like the quality of the product, the durability of the product. You know, like there's so many times I'll see customers out there skiing on a pair of Icelantics that they're 10 plus years old and they are still skiing great. They're having so much fun on them. You know, so I think really when you think about the monetary value of the product that we're making and truly a lot of the products that are out there, you know, any ski company that's making a product and, you know, is successful in this industry is making a good ski. You know, not every ski is for every person, obviously, but everyone's making a good ski. So, you know, what we really would try to pride ourselves on is when you make an investment in buying a pair of Icelantics, it is built to last. You are going to be able to have this product and ski on it for many years to come. You know, hopefully you're going to come back to our brand to reinvest or, you know, continue to potentially build a quiver with different skis for different type of conditions. But I think that's one thing to continue to remember is like, yes, it's getting more and more expensive to, you know, to participate in this sport. But when you do make that investment, it's a good long-term, you know, investment. And I also think it's our responsibility to continue to think of how do we continue to make it more, you know, just appeal and just more, inviting to other customers, like to other people, you know, people that can't afford to spend, you know, $800, $900 on a pair of skis. You know, like when I think about that, when I look at just being lucky enough to be in this industry and the experiences that I've got to have, you know, for a fraction of the price, you know, I'm like, man, like when I really get down to it, like, if I'm fully investing in this without any sort of benefit, like it's a big investment. There's no doubt about it. And that does deter a lot of people out there. So, you know, as a brand for us too, like we're also continuing to think like, how do we continue to make this, like offer this to a broader range of people? Because it's just like I keep saying, it's about having fun. It's getting in the mountains. It's so healthy on every different level. So how do we just make it more attainable? And I think there's a lot of ways that we can do that through kind of recycling our product, you know, like the customers that can afford to buy new pairs of skis every year, every few years, you know, how can we kind of recycle this product and transition it down to, you know, to the next level of the people that can't quite afford that and so on. So, you know, that's something that we're personally just kind of continuing to think about. You know, there's a lot of logistics in that and really strategic ways to think about it, but it's something that is definitely top of mind right now of like, how do we, you know, utilize this long-term durability truly to our advantage compared to it being a deterring factor of like, well, if you had skis that didn't last 10 years, you know, you'd have a return customer faster. So,
yeah, I mean, I get that. But one thing I think like the price of skis have not changed that much in like 10 years. Like,
yeah.
Was the Shaman around 10 years ago?
Yeah.
What did it cost?
Yeah. I don't even know. Probably like $4.99.
Did it
I don't
cost
even
that
know.
Much?
I don't even
I mean,
know.
Like we have like the Wildcat, like 10 years ago as a Bibby, it was $6.99 and now it's $7.79. Like it hasn't gone up that much, but the cost of doing business has gone up dramatically.
Oh yeah.
And that's kind of was.
Oh yeah. We've just eaten margin. I mean,
yeah. Like the margin gets smaller for us. Like back then, like we didn't have any margin because we were smaller.
Yeah.
You know, but like what we have to do on our side is like optimize the business and how efficient we make stuff in the factory.
Yeah.
And you know, there's a whole side talk of automation and like, man, the big European factories, those guys are getting crazy with robots and we've got like little robots, but still like, it's not the answer. It's not the answer, but yeah, the armor factories are scary. Robot. Yeah. They're scary what they can do. Like they just put a ski in one side, it comes out the other in the plastic. It's incredibly impressive what they're doing over there. But that's not what we're really about. But, I mean, there's just so many avenues to talk about before answering your core question. You know, like the overall cost of skis has gone up. And I know when we look at the price of skis every year, like we just did it to, you know, figure out next year's pricing. And it's, skiing is such a weird thing. You know, it's not volatile like gas prices. You know, so we have to decide now what the skis are going to cost next year. And we don't understand all the economic factors which will happen between now and when the skis are released. So it's pretty challenging, right? Because you want to be competitive with everyone else. And you need to look at what your costs are. And like some crazy thing can happen in the Middle East and like the cost of, you know, your sidewall material from Austria can go up because like there's like some crazy thing in the cargo shipping world, you know? So it's pretty crazy. And then when winter starts, you're locked into that price all year long.
I know. Yeah. We changed our price like during COVID. I mean, what was happening month after month after month was insane, like the increases.
Oh, it was insane.
Yeah, so we did have to change our prices mid-production cycle one of the years. I can't remember, it was probably 2020 or 2021, but mid-cycle, we're like, we can't just eat all this. You know, it's gonna tank the business, you know? So we had to, you know, pass it on, not 100% of it, but it's like, you know, we need to increase our wholesale costs, you know, $25, which then, you know, increases the retail cost by $50 or whatever it is, knowing that the cost was still, you know, a $50 increase, you know? So it's like, we're taking a hit. And, you know, the retailer was kind of like where it was built into, like, they didn't really take a hit, but yeah, it's challenging. I also think that everything's resetting right now, like prices in general, like it's not going back down, you know? So like, it's definitely in turmoil right now, but I think once it resettles on some levels, you know, I think there's been some shock with the cost of skis going up over the last couple of years, but I think it's gonna normalize on some levels. Like, I hope it does, but that's challenging. And it is such a unique industry because there's really not another industry that I can think of that is met with so much resistance. And I'm not even technically from the consumer, but from dealers, consumer, and even just internally, like, wow, you know, I have these thresholds in my head, like, oh, over $800, that's crazy. Now it's like, okay, over $900 is crazy. And, you know, now, you know, and that's just continuing to go up. So
I agree with that.
It's going to normalize. Yeah.
That's the scary thing too. Like, because like when we look at the pricing and what it costs to make something, I just know looking at the cost of the ski is like what I want it to cost and the accessibility that I want of the product, but I also need to run a business. Yeah. But my personal perception has changed. Like at our factory, we have a factory store. And a couple years ago, like the price of the skis and bindings have gone up a little bit, maybe $75 in the last couple years since COVID. But I remember before all these big price increases, I would go down and help a customer and sell them a pair of skis with like Look Pivot 15s on them, check them out, and it was like $1,400. And I would be like afraid to say the number because I'm like, oh my gosh, that's so much money. Yeah. But now when I go to the factory store and I check someone out, I'm like, that's a good deal. Like, just of all the other bills I've had to pay, you know? Like, they're like, you're going to scream a deal here, you know? And that's just how the world is now. It's super messed up. Yeah, like, I don't know. Like, it's so weird. Yeah. But
no, one thing that I think is so unique in this industry too is like the pricing structure based on width of ski, you know, where it's like the narrower, the fatter the ski, the more expensive it is versus the narrower is, the cheaper it is. And that's just like crazy for me to think about, you know, the cost of making it. I mean, it's minuscule in terms of the material difference, you know, so like the cost of actually making it for us, at least, is like, is not that much, but you know, we're making less margin on this and more on this. We're like, Sturman's is doing this with Wonder right now, where it's just a set price across the board. You know, the quality is the same, the performance is different, you know, and you really go and find the shape and the size that works best for you, for your skill set, for your area. But, you know, when you're investing in a pair of Icelantics, you know the durability you're getting, you know the quality you're getting, and it's worth this much. So that's something that I've thought about. We haven't done it and we're not doing it next year because we've already figured out a pricing for next year, but it's something that I've thought about. It's just more of this, like, you know, consistent pricing and not really basing, you know, really thinking like a fatter ski is not better quality. It's just better for a certain type of condition. So that's just something that's been built into this industry that I'm like, this doesn't really make sense, you know?
Thoughts on that?
No, I completely agree. Yeah, it's funny. I mean, like when you make a skinny ski, you just throw away more material.
Yeah.
Get more in your ski when you have a fatter ski.
Yeah.
I mean, you can save a little bit with a narrow ski, but like the cost to build a narrow ski with the same materials as a wide ski, it's like, it's dollars. It's very little difference.
Yeah.
But the market dictates a pretty substantially different price tag.
Yeah. Normally, like, I mean, at least $100, you know, from like, you know, a low 90s to a, you know, 110-ish, you know, somewhere in there, like it's about $100 difference, you know?
Yeah.
Just kind of crazy, you know.
Let's switch topics and go a bit more into the design side of things, materials and design side of things. Well, Luke, the floor is yours. I'm not even giving you a question. You don't like this.
You gave Red Gerard questions.
What's that?
You gave Red questions.
Yeah, but he didn't tap the table.
Sorry. I didn't know. You didn't warn me. That's,
Jesus.
Did I get booed or did he get booed? Wait, who's booed?
I did get booed. No,
you didn't. Wait, that crowd is turning. All right.
I'm Italian.
I like to check in every so often to see from ski builders' point of views. I know that they're... is a pretty constant sense of like, what are the new materials out there? And it's not linear, right? There might be certain jumps at certain points of times in materials. Where are we in your view right now? Is it a bit more stagnant than it's been? Is it more iterative than revolutionary? Where are we in terms of what you guys see? And you have maybe suppliers coming through and saying, you should check out this new. And you're like, wow, that's really interesting. Or not so much. Where are we today on that front?
You know, it feels like we're at the early stages of some big change. You know, I think that when people are looking at sustainability, for instance, you know, there's a desire to find more sustainable materials, a more sustainable way to make skis, you know? Is the solution there yet? I don't think it is. You know, like there's some little things you can do or whatever, but I think that that focus is going to make some big changes. I don't know what this timeline is, but I think that'll be an interesting piece. But truly, like when you look at just making a ski anywhere in the world, it's pretty consistent, you know? So the materials that your people are using, the processes, you know, it's getting more automated, but you know, for us, so much of it is like continuing to look at what's out there, you know, stay true to who we are and continue to evolve our current process. And that's the other thing too, is like the challenges of taking some of these, you know, radical potential ideas, but systemizing it into a place to get it to a production level, you know? So, you know, I think for us, like the focusing on simplicity, and I think is such a key piece for us right now of like simplifying what we're offering to the customer. And, you know, when you look at the amount of decisions or options out there from all the other brands, even just our collection, if you're looking just at what does Icelandic have? What do I want? You know, so like for me, I'm like, you know, efficiency is one of the key pieces, like boil it down, you know, what are the core pieces of like, what are the core models that we want to offer? Then having some offshoot creative outlets, you know, that we're playing with, you know, radical materials that aren't, you know, confined as much by the price. You know, this isn't the mass market type of ski. It's not what we're offering everywhere, but I'm kind of rambling right now, but, you know, just really kind of like continuing to lean into it. And I think the direction is there. And I think with just the creative thinkers, not only in this industry, but in the world, like, there's going to be some pretty good leaps. I don't know exactly what that timeline is.
Yeah. I mean, the sustainability thing, it's definitely what you see being pushed from all outdoor brands. It's an important marketing story. We all care about the outside. We like to be there. But it is incredibly challenging to, I mean, skis get so abused and they get flexed and bent and they run in the rocks and you pay a lot of money for them and you want them to hold up. Mm-hmm. And the challenging thing with new materials, like skiing is just a small sector of composites and resins and epoxies and plastics and all these different parts that go into it, into a much bigger economic world of all those elements. So I don't know if I think that trying new things and trying to bring sustainability into skiing and manufacturing is great, but I don't think the answers are going to be found in ski manufacturing. It's going to be from some bigger industry that we utilize components of. I mean, there's a lot of really cool companies out there that are trying things, like you were bringing up, Wonder Alpine and Sturbins and Checker Spot. They're doing cool things, trying really cool stuff. But like, I don't know the exact number, but a good percentage of the LG is 50% of it's like bad stuff still. You know, they're blending it. And there's a lot of cool materials that get brought to us, and they don't work by themselves. They always need to be blended with the bad stuff. And so because they need to hold up, it's there's no easy answer. On the moment side of things, you know, what we want to do and what we look to do is we try to optimize our manufacturing to reduce waste. Be really particular about making certain parts that go into skis universal, so we can order a part that is perfect almost from the raw material supplier and cut it with little waste, versus making different parts and throwing a lot in the trash or trying to recycle certain things. Because, you know, the whole recycling world, I mean, it's super challenging to recycle some of these materials, even though they are recyclable. There just aren't people that do it, or you have to pay more to get it recycled than you do to throw it away. So it's challenging as like just an economic world thing, you know? So it's difficult. I mean, it's just outdoor people push for it. It's important. But I don't know if we're going to have the answers. It'd be cool if we did, but we got to push and try for sure.
Is this to say that on the materials front, the primary thing is materials that still hold up, work well, that are more sustainable? I don't hear either of you talking a lot about, I don't hear either of you saying there's these new materials and we're going to get this incredible performance gain. And this gets into something we've talked a lot about at Blister, is kind of sustainability is performance, but we're just talking about when I'm standing at the top of the head wall and I'm going to ski down, you know, that you're not seeing new materials right now where it's like, oh my God, I can do the thing that I say, don't trust when brands say this, we can pull 400 grams out of a ski and it's going to ski as well as a ski that's weighs 400 grams more. That, you know, when we're talking about that type of performance thing, I don't hear you guys talking about that. You're talking about the more sustainable materials. Is that fair?
Yeah. I mean, I think trying to find these materials to at least be equal to the current performance, that's the challenge now, let alone surpassing it. You know, I think one of the biggest challenges, you know, that we've talked about internally is just like bonding. You know, like, yeah, you can get all these sustainable materials and then you pour a bunch of resin on it. You know what I mean? It's like, and then once all these materials are saturated in resin, how do you recycle it? You know what I mean? Like, it's a really tough thing. So like, I think one of the, some potential in the future is like thinking of different ways to get materials to bond in a way that can still create the characteristics of the flex and the, you know, rigidity and just all the different pieces for performance. But thinking differently than the traditional resin approach. You know, I don't have that expertise, you know, but I think that that's just how we need to start thinking about truly, you know, evolving this. Because even when you think about recycling a product or whatever, like, sure, we can grind up skis and make something else, but, you know, eventually it's turning to waste. It's every one of these steps, it's, you know, reducing the quality of whatever you're making. So eventually it turns into waste, where is there an opportunity to build something that can be potentially broken down with zero waste, or rebuilt in a way to keep it, you know, the cradle to cradle approach. I don't know if you guys are familiar with that, but it's that type of approach or thinking that I think needs to happen to really make change. You know, there's a lot of things that you can do with some, you know, green pieces and, you know, and I mean, a lot of it's marketing, you know, it's like, it's not going to really enhance the performance or the piece, but I just want to see, you know, a true change, you know, and I don't know if we'll get to there or not, but
I don't know. There is an epoxy company in Europe that is working with our top sheet supplier and a major European manufacturer, where they can build the ski and then they can pour a chemical on it and all the parts come.
Wow.
I haven't gotten that memo. But I don't know how durable that ski is. Yeah. But yeah, I don't know. Sustainability, we kind of went off on that tangent. But as far as new materials go, like there's nothing revolutionary, right? Like there's marketing copy. There's certain brands that will say something is there. But really it's how you blend the materials and how you utilize them and trying different things and not trying the same old thing that we've done for a long time, is really what we look to and just try to optimize the use of the materials. You know, we've been doing this for 20 years, which is a decent amount of time, but you know, every year we learn something new on how to use these materials and how to lay them up and, you know, just, I mean, the smallest changes that you put into a ski can change so much on how it feels to the skier, right? And skiing style changes and snow changes. So, and different attributes are more popular and come and go as fads, right? So how do we utilize that in the ski? But no crazy new materials.
No crazy new materials. I want to open it up. If you guys have questions, start going that way.
Cool. I have a kind of interesting one. So I have a thing for just like abusing the shit out of my skis.
Awesome.
Like, and core shots are unfortunately like a thing. In sort of like a blue sky or like dreamland kind of world, do you think it would be possible to make a ski that is immune to core shot damage? Would you be making it out of like diamonds or just like a sheet of metal? Or is that just like the nature of, to get a performance from a ski, you inherently have that weakness?
Huh. Well, I mean, you got to think about how much force you're putting into the ski. Like, let's say we just put a sheet of hardened steel on the bottom of your ski and you sent even a 10-foot cliff onto a rock. Like, that steel is going to get damaged. And then it's going to cause crazy drag. And it's going to be slow. It's not going to absorb any wax. Like, it's like, it depends, that durability versus performance, right? On how to manufacture it. Like, it would be cool. We've thought about like making park skis with like replaceable edges and how to do that in a cost effective level, like in making it an affordable park ski, because like edges crack and then things happen and the ski starts to delaminate and the kid's like, this is a warranty. And it's like, no, it's not. Yeah. But, yeah. So
I know. Yeah. A while ago, I was working with a kid at School of Mines in Golden, and he was working on, this was like, I mean, over 10 years ago, but we were doing like cryogenically frozen edges to prevent that. And he was testing on like razors, that type of stuff. And, you know, we could test the edge where it'd be like, but it was getting too hard where you couldn't even sharpen it, you know? So it was like, oh, we have this like frozen, like this cryogenically frozen edge, but the steel was too hard. So like what you had to do to actually sharpen it to the point to utilize it was too much. So I don't know. We do warranty everything, so if you want to get some ice lantern, 3-year warranty, no questions asked.
So this is what we're going to try to do is we're going to try to get through the questions for the good folks who are standing there. So we'll try to just be a little bit quicker and yeah.
This question's not as good as the last question, but I thought all the discussion about pricing was really interesting because there are parts of the ski industry which don't hesitate to raise their prices to meet input costs. And I don't think the costs of, you know, the amount they're paying instructors at Vail or Jackson Hole have increased by the amount that they've raised their lesson prices every year. So why is it that gear and, you know, gear brands who skiers presumably are more favorably inclined to than they are to Vail and Alterra don't have that pricing control when other parts of the industry don't seem to have that problem? Sorry. Should I repeat the question?
I think I can do it pretty quick. We'll see. We're seeing price increases in other parts of the ski industry big time. And then finish this. Well, do you know what he said? You heard him.
Yeah, it's like skiing people like Vail less than they like, you know, Icelandic. Why can Vail raise their prices? And you can't.
Well, we want people to like us, so we keep them low.
Yes. You know, I don't know. I mean, it's really looking at the the competition landscape too. You know, I mean, when you look at a lot of our competitors, you know, they're either publicly traded companies or, you know, government subsidized factories or the stuff where like they're not quite as dependent on the margin to create a sustainable product. So they can make a little bit less or, you know, keep a, you know, traditional price. And, you know, it's the challenge of like, how do we continue to show the value of investing in Icelandic versus XYZ brand? It's tough, you know, so, you know, we've gotten a little bit above, you know, a lot of the core competitors that we have right now, but we can't alienate ourselves too much. So, it's kind of looking at the overall market. You know, I really do a lot of price strategy and just kind of look across the board, like, and sure, there's the, you know, the very introductory type skis that are always going to be cheap. But, you know, really when you look at the core models that we're competing against, it's pretty amazing, like how much they have it. And truly even going into next year, some of them are coming back in price, you know, where it's like, and they're going for that mass market, you know, approach compared to higher margins, more of the quantity approach. So it's a tough industry to compete against. So it's kind of all of those factors that help find a fair price. You know, one thing that we do have an advantage of is kind of that balance of, you know, selling our skis through wholesale outlets as well as, you know, direct to consumer. So, you know, that's one little thing is like, okay, we can keep our price competitive, but we need to shift some of our focus to get more of our sales going direct to us where it's a little bit higher margin compared to going to a wholesaler where, you know, we have built our pricing strategies around. So there's that to play as well, but it's really just a competitive industry that we're a small fish for sure.
If you could design one ski that you don't make or doesn't exist yet, what would it be?
I'll sign it $8
in front of the videos. Yeah. Wow.
One ski.
Wow.
Stopped in front of the camera.
Yeah. Drink.
Yeah. I designed an invisible ski that could stand in front of the camera.
What would you
type
design?
Of ski that I would design?
That hasn't been designed yet?
The one with the diamond bases.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, that's a cool one.
I'm thinking about that one now.
Yeah, but core shots aren't that bad to fix. The rail kits are way more annoying. I'll fix the edge problem first. But yeah.
Okay.
So, yeah.
I mean, I have the ski that I love.
Yeah.
I don't know what I'd make. I mean, maybe just that the some sort of a fusion type, new type of construction that, you know, could be broken down without any waste and then kind of rebuilt in a way. But in terms of a shape, I don't know. I love our Shaman. What about you?
It evolves with time. I don't know. There's not like one thing that I have in my mind that like can't be done. Like if it's something that I want to make, we're working on it. I don't think there's anything that's in our wheelhouse that we've thought of yet that is like maybe impossible. As fun as that question is, I want to think about that more. But
yeah,
I don't know.
Okay, my name's Ganhi. I have two sides of the same question. Similar to that guy, what is the limiting factor that keeps you from making or designing the ski that you want? Is it materials, automation, manufacturing process, design, technology, what is it? And on the other side, what do you think the big change in the industry from skis is going to be? Because we've kind of had this convergence where every ski brand, whether it's a big brand or a ski brand, has their free ride ski, freestyle ride, and it's kind of the same. And what's that next version of like shape skis from like straight skis or like rocker, right? Like what's that next thing?
You know, I think one of the beauties about both of our businesses is that we can kind of create the shapes that we want to make, you know, like we don't have too many outside factors coming in, be like, oh no, that's too creative. That's too crazy to think about. So, you know, I think just the skis that we're continuing to design and put out to the market are kind of those creative shapes that we want to create. What was the second part of the question?
What's the limiting factor?
Or next shapes.
Oh, you know, next shapes, you know, one of the shape concepts that I've been intrigued with, and it is kind of out there, but just continuing to play with full rocker. I mean, we were just talking about this earlier.
Yeah.
Just full rocker technology, you know, just when you think about it, it's always for powder. And of course, it creates flotation and it keeps it surfy. But really, when you think about it, it's kind of just like a pre-flex ski. So we've played around with some shapes like that where the, you know, the radius of the rocker is the same as the radius of the side cut. So it really just skis like a flexed ski. And so when you're skiing it flat, it's super nimble. But when you roll this thing on edge, you get full edge control and it can carve a turn. And we've been talking a lot, or I've been thinking a lot about like taking some of that technology and it, you know, implementing into kids skis or like, you know, more beginner style skis where it's like, it's so forgiving, but then it'll really teach someone how to use an edge. And I think it's a tough sell, you know, because when people think about full rocker, it's like, no, I'm not, you know, I'm not a powder person, but that's something that I've been thinking about is like how to take that concept and apply it to more of a, you know, of a mass market or normalized.
Yeah. I mean, full rocker's fun. You can utilize it in a lot of different spots and it's cool. Shape is important, but I think on the topic of shape, like skiing had so many amazing advancements in the last 20 years with the twin tip and fat skis and rocker. Like things went super fat for so long and things got obnoxiously rockered.
Even side
and,
cut.
And side cut. Yeah, I love the BBR. Yes. Like so many crazy things happened. And still every year we get so, and that's only been 20 years though.
Yeah.
Like we are still refining all those pieces because we went so fast and so quick. And people were just buying the biggest, most rocker thing ever. And there wasn't any thought to it. It was just bigger, badder, you know? And so we're still refining things. I think it's a slow move. Like we are definitely went through a really amazing renaissance of ski design. I don't think there's anything crazy revolutionary coming, but I think that every year that the brands play with all the different shapes and side cuts and rockers, like there's not a lot of people that are skiing skis over 120 underfoot anymore, unless they have like a super niche powder skier going to AK or something like that. I mean, I still have skis that big and they're awesome. I'm not saying they're dead, but like you can have so much fun on a ski that's, you know, 115 underfoot and it skis so much better than the skis that were 130 underfoot 15 years ago. You know, so
it's also pretty amazing how much small tweaks make a big difference, you know? So it's like, instead of like completely rethinking about doing something totally different, it's like you take, you know, I mean, we're in the process of redesigning our Nomad and Maiden collection. You know, this is a ski that I was building in the garage 20 years ago. It's literally the same shape, you know, the wrong widths, but the same shape, but we're continuing to make tweaks to it. And like, you literally make small tweaks to these concepts that have developed over the last 20 years. And it's pretty amazing to see the performance change and just how it really applies to the different type of skiers out there and just more fun.
There was a comment earlier that the market dictates that it's okay for a wider ski to cost more than a less wide ski, even if it's made with the same raw materials and the same manufacturing process. That comment surprises me coming from you guys. You seem to have some control over that. If it only costs incrementally more to make that ski a little bit wider, why is it your skis cost more? Why does the market dictate that when you can dictate it?
Yeah, I mean, I think for both of our brands, you know, the fatter skis are kind of our baseline. You know, that's where that's what we're selling. That's what, you know, the majority of our sales. So we kind of build our margin structure around those, which are the fatter skis, which in, you know, the result of that is the narrower skis that we're doing, we are making less margin off of because we're not trying to gouge the fat skis and then, you know, have this as the baseline. We're really basing it off what we're selling more of. And then it gets down to looking at the competition. You know what I mean? It's like, okay, when you're looking at a ski wall and you're looking at something, you know, 90 underfoot and you have XYZ options and this one's $200 or $300 more than this one, you know, like, I don't know. Like that's where I say the market like kind of dictates.
It sounds like you're saying that you right price the wider ski and sell the narrower ski
100%
at a bit of a discount.
Yeah, yeah. We make
looking at it the other way around, which is a little bit of how it sounded earlier.
Yeah, no, we make the like our fatter skis are kind of the baseline that we have, and then the narrow skis we like. Luckily, we sell less of them, but we make less on them too. If that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right, team.
I agree with that. Yeah.
Team, remember, Operation Keep Jason Blevins Alive. So I'm shutting this down in 2 minutes. I'm serious. So let's move quick because, yeah.
You guys have talked about some of the disadvantages to being small brands playing against big fish in the pond, like robots and publicly traded companies. Like, what do you each feel is like your silver bullet advantage, if you have to be optimistic for a second, being a small brand? Is it on the brand side? Is it on the product side, et cetera?
It's on rapid prototyping and not being constrained by all these people that have an opinion on the ski. We don't need to make a ski for everybody in 50 different countries. We make skis for us, for skiers, for our friends, and for the consumers that we communicate with. You know, we don't need to make generic skis. And that's a huge advantage and why we, I think, both love making skis and being able to connect with skiers and come here, because this is at the start of the whole thing. We made skis because we love skiing, and we're still skiers first and businessmen second.
Yeah, I would say the same. Yeah. Just the creativity, you know, it's like just coming up with a concept and then bringing it to life quick. You know what I mean? Like that type of freedom or is just, it keeps me alive. It keeps me going. You know, I love it. So that's definitely the piece.
First time caller, long time listener. Why do ski graphics matter? Why do you guys put so much effort into ski graphics? And why have you both primarily worked with one artist for the last 20 years to develop what we all know and recognize today?
We have a love-hate relationship with our college buddy.
For me, like, our artist Travis Parry is like a co-founder. I mean, we grew up together since we were 12, and he was going to art school, called him up, just said, hey, you know, I'd love to, I'm starting this ski company, and, you know, do you want to create the graphics? And it is tough doing business with an artist sometimes, obviously, but, it's fun, you know, like, and I think there's substance behind what we create. You know, I look out there and like, there's a lot of people putting, you know, art on it, but like handmade approach, just like really taking original paintings, put them on the skis, and just storytelling, you know, like just inspiring, and just like the storytelling that we're going to do to complement the product, I think is super important, as well as a differentiator. There's no question about that. You know, like it's such a core differentiator as a brand for people to recognize, like, oh, Icelandic, you know, like artwork, blah, 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 whatever it may be. But it's just who we are. I think it's a perfect example of kind of that creativity side. You know, like when we started, I mean, we would come up with an idea. He would literally take them, create all the original paintings, like on the canvas, like with the shape of the ski traced. He'd paint the logo on it, and then we'd photo and put it on it, you know? And it's like, it's crazy to think about how that's kind of evolved over the years. But I think it's just an expression of our brand. It's who we truly are. And it's just another fun outlet to differentiate our product versus everything else out there.
Yeah, it's a little similar for us. I mean, growing up in the 80s, 90s with like more of like a rock and roll, punk rock, DIY culture, like that's what I was around. Like growing up, I was a ski racer. I did all that. And like I was on Atomic Beta Carves, which I call butt crack technology, if you guys remember those skis. And they looked like, you know, F1 race cars. And I had my friends with these custom painted Burton 7s that were so cool. And I was watching old MacDog production snowboard videos. And like, that's a revolution of twin tips and all that stuff. Like none of it was speaking to me. And the major European brands had no idea what we were doing in Tahoe. And like, I just like beyond having a ski shape, like I wanted a brand that represented my core values and the things that I like, and bringing cultures of, hey, what are we going to do for a ski graphic? Let's put mountains on them. Where'd you come up with that idea? Jesus Christ. Like, let's do something cool. Like, we just like to have fun with it. And it's just the culture that we came up with it. And we like to keep it punk rock.
It's also challenging too, because, you know, art is subjective. You know what I mean?
Like, totally. Love
it or
hate
it. It can definitely be a polarizing factor. It can be a selling point, but also it can be polarizing. So, you know, that's been some of the challenge over the years of like, okay, how do we create this authentic artwork that we put on skis, but how do we continue to look at the type of customer it's gonna attract? It's a give and take.
Well, Ben and Luke, you're the best. Thank you for sharing the perspectives. It's a lot for us to think about and hopefully give us a better understanding of how this world, weird world works. So thank you.
Yeah. Yes, thank you.
Thanks for staying for the B squad.
Well, that's it for this edition of Gear 30. I want to say thanks to Luke and Ben for the great conversation. Thanks to the strikingly handsome Justin Bob for producing this episode, and thanks to you for listening. And from our entire team here at Blister, we hope you all have a fantastic weekend, and we will talk to you again this coming Monday over on our Blister podcast, where, once again, it is time for Cody Townsend and me to review the news. So subscribe to our Blister podcast if you haven't done so already, and then the minute we drop that episode Monday morning, you're going to get it right from our little podcast studio oven into your preferred podcast player. All right, everybody, have a great weekend. Talk to you on Monday.